Zionism and Judaism are not the same thing at all, but two entirely different things, perhaps even two contradictory things. At any rate, they are not the same. A man becomes a Zionist when he can't be a Jew anymore. If those generations of patient dreamers represent what it has meant to be Jewish, then the kibbutzniks of the Haganah may embody not the fulfillment of Judaism, but its repudiation.
Welcome to The Stories Jews Tell, a weekly podcast with Professor Ruth Weiss, brought to you by the Tikva Fund. This week we'll be reading The Sermon by Chaim Chazaz. This season of The Stories Jews Tell is sponsored by Robert L. Friedman.
Our story today is The Sermon by Chaim Chazaz. I'm using the translation of Hillel Halkin rather than the earlier but equally reliable one by the Jewish historian Ben Halpern. And the fact that two such distinguished thinkers translated this story tells us that we are dealing here with a classic of Zionist and modern Hebrew literature. The story was published in the Land of Israel in 1942, at a desperate moment in the history of the Jewish people. Palestine was then under the British Mandate, which prevented Jewish immigration to the country, even as the Nazis were exterminating the Jews of Europe. The Jews of the Yishuv, the Jewish community of Palestine, had formed their own secret defense force, the Haganah, knowing that they would have to fight the Arabs, and possibly also the British, to win sovereignty in their homeland. The story is situated in a kibbutz whose Haganah members had immigrated from Russia in their youth. And so too Chaim Chazaz, who was born in Russia in 1898. As a young man already launched as a Hebrew writer, he was shaken by the Bolshevik Revolution. But unlike so many of his contemporaries who welcomed the Soviet promise, he feared for the Jewish world that it was bent on destroying. So in 1921, he left Russia never to return. He lived for a time in Istanbul, then Berlin, and after many years in Paris, he went on Aliyah in 1931. Most of his writing before and after his arrival in Palestine was about life in Russia, about the effects of the revolution on the community he had left behind. Now this story, the one we're talking about here, was among the first to be situated when and where he actually was. The story's title, Hadrasha, the sermon, evokes a rabbi before a congregation, but its opening turns this expectation upside down. It opens like this. Yudka didn't talk much. He never spoke in public, never argued at meetings or at conferences, rarely opened his mouth when anyone else was around. He was reputed to be a man of few words, and though he was not what he was reputed to be, his reputation grew on him so that in the end he quite lost the knack of saying anything coherent out loud, no matter how trivial or important it was. Which was why his comrades in the Haganah were surprised when they heard that he proposed to address a certain committee whose existence was a secret to all but a chosen few, especially since the committee had been convened that day solely to hear him speak. Now, Yudka is a typical Israeli name of that generation, but it also suggests a typical Jew, Yudka. Through a string of negatives, we learn that our preacher is the unlikeliest of orators. For synagogue, substitute in Israeli kibbutz. For the Sabbath, an impromptu meeting to hear the disjointed thoughts of an unhappy member. Chaim Chazaz might have called his story the protest, since it consists entirely of Yudka's improvised remarks to the committee that evening. These Jews, very different from what the Jews once were, are gathered for an unusual event. Yudka works as a stonemason and does dangerous night patrols, yet when it comes to the meeting that he requested, he is nervous about getting started. The chairman and his comrades are all men of action, impatient to know why they are there. Yudka finally blurts it out. "I wish to announce," he said in a low voice, "that I object to Jewish history." The men all laugh, and the man who laughs loudest is the one who took Yudka's wife away from him, which adds humiliation to this portrait of a misfit. In literature, There is nothing sorrier than the cuckold, who cannot satisfy his woman and who has his woman taken away from him. So one can hardly imagine a less impressive speaker. But these Haganah members have convened to hear him out, and so do we. Eini mechabed ha-historia ha-yehudit. I don't respect Jewish history. Ani mitnaged. I am opposed to it, because we never made our own history. The Goyim always made it for us, just as they turned out the lights for us, and lit the stove for us, and milked the cow for us on the Sabbath. So they made history for us, the way they wanted, and we took it whether we liked it or not, but it wasn't ours. It wasn't ours at all. Yudka's first objection to what he calls Jewish history is its passivity. He cites the custom of hiring Gentiles to perform tasks that were forbidden to Jews on Sabbath and holidays, and he uses this as a metaphor for Jewish national dependency, insisting, here's the zadvostka, I don't know how to say it in Hebrew, here's where the dog lies buried. His recourse to Russian for emphasis, his critical reliance on a Gentile language, seems to reinforce the point that he's making, that Jews are dependent on others. He speaks as a product of the diaspora, whose history he now wants to erase. The case against the Galut is being made by the person who best represents it. The Hebrew of these men is new. Their native languages are Russian and Yiddish. Everything about this scene is new and improvised. The country they're reclaiming, the agricultural collective called kibbutz, Jews forming their own army, all of this is radically different from the way they were raised, and Yudka wants to ensure that there is no going back. He says, Jewish history is simply boring. It has no adventures, no conquering heroes, no great rulers or potentates. All it has is a mob of beaten, groaning, weeping, begging Jews. And you'll agree with me that there's nothing interesting about that. Nothing. If it were up to me, I wouldn't allow our children to be taught Jewish history at all. Why on earth should we teach them anything about the shameful life of their ancestors? I would simply say to them, look, boys and girls, we don't have any history. We haven't had one since the day we were driven into exile. Class dismissed. You can go outside now and play. Hazaz was hardly the first to air these ideas. In 1882, another Russian Jew, Leon Pinsker, had argued in very similar terms that although Jews once stood on equal footing with other nations, they lost the essential defining attributes of a nation when they lost their land. To end the ghost-like nature of diaspora Jews, Pinsker issued a call for auto-emancipation, and 15 years later, that became the Zionist movement. Yudka echoes Pinsker, but in the past tense, from the perspective of those who have already corrected the problem by moving to Israel and resettling their homeland. Why then is he not triumphant? Why doesn't he just declare mission accomplished? Well, in 1942, when Hazaz wrote this story, the establishment of the Jewish state was by no means assured. Theodor Herzl and fellow Zionists may have dreamed of peaceful coexistence with their fellow Semites, but Arab aggression had only hardened. The Mufti of Jerusalem was actively encouraging Hitler to complete the final solution, and the British were staying neutral by preventing Jews from reaching Palestine. It would take incalculable effort to reclaim Jewish sovereignty when millions of defenseless Jews were being hounded to death. And meanwhile, some Jews themselves needed convincing. 2,000 years of Talmudic civilization had persuaded many of them that they could continue to survive in exile waiting for the divine promise of being returned to Zion. If salvation was to come from some divine intervention, why should they bother with kibbutz pioneering? Now, Yudka anticipates and shoots down all these objections. Jews may say they manifested great courage through centuries of suffering, but their heroism of despair, as he calls it, deserves no respect. Reacting to conditions that you are forced to endure is a function not of choice but of necessity, and there is nothing heroic about it. Suffering is even worse if you make a virtue of martyrdom. "Look at me," our heroes of suffering began to say. "Look at what disaster, at what humiliation, at what disgrace I can bear. Who else in the whole world is as good at it as I am?" From this moonlight psychology of endurance, Yudka turns his contempt on Jewish theology. "Jewish national character has been fatally misshapen," he says. "The rabbis say that the passage in Ecclesiastes, V'hachut ha-mishulash, lo bimheira yenatek, the threefold cord is not readily broken, that this refers to exile, martyrdom, and Messiah." Well, that's it then. As long as Jews valued exile and martyrdom, they could never bring the Messiah they claimed to wish for. Belief in the Messiah, eternal expectation, meant the Jews never actually had to return to the land to do whatever was necessary to reclaim it. It was the perfect excuse for inertia. Jews say they persisted for 2,000 years because of their faith in the Messiah, an ingenious legend, but false. The longing for Jerusalem did not lead to the eventual recovery of Jerusalem. It was intended to prevent return to the land of Israel. If you're waiting for the Messiah, you do not have to move to dirty, malaria-ridden Palestine. Yudka is sick and tired of turning to the east in prayer instead of sailing to the east in ships. Had it not been for the myth, he thinks, Jews would finally have had to go right back to Palestine or somehow or other pass on out of the world. The myth is what sustained the lie. Jews were not being hypocritical in affirming their faith and trust in the Messiah, but the longer they did it, the less they were inclined to get up and actually redeem the land. There was a term for the ideas that Yudka was propounding, Shlilat HaGola, negation of the diaspora. The kibbutz generation of this story, like Hazaz himself, had come to the country livnotu lehibanotba, to build and be rebuilt, which for some of them included eliminating the wreckage of the past. A local group calling itself the Canaanites aspired to return Hebrew language and culture to their pre-Talmudic values, and David Ben-Gurion, as head of the Jewish government in formation, was implementing some of Yudka's ideas by insisting that the new country's generals adopt Hebraic names and that the population phase out Yiddish entirely. Yudka formulates these ideas tentatively as though they were just emerging, yet no writer in the Yishuv had ever voiced them with such concentrated belligerence. But wait a minute. Although no one around the table, through these many pages of talk, objects, except to urge him to get to the point, Yudka's attack is so effective that he himself suddenly realizes where his line of reasoning has brought him. He has come by another route to the position of the ultra-Orthodox. If his Zionism denies so much of Jewish history, might it not be rejecting Judaism as well? "If I'm right," he says, "if I'm right, Zionism and Judaism are not the same thing at all, but two entirely different things, perhaps even two contradictory things, most certainly two contradictory things. At any rate, they are not the same. A man becomes a Zionist when he can't be a Jew anymore." If those generations of patient dreamers represent what it has meant to be Jewish, then the kibbutzniks of the Haganah may embody not the fulfillment of Judaism, but its repudiation. In his fumbling way, Yudka sees that none of the Zionist leaders really addressed the questions that he is raising. Herzl took up the political problem of acquiring a Jewish state. Ahad Ha'am believed the regeneration of a national Jewish culture would have to precede the physical return to Zion. Set up a Jewish study circle, or build a school. At the mention of Jewish culture, the kibbutzniks break the tension, which has really been building, to poke fun at the German Jewish professors whom they and author Chaim Hazaz disdained, members of Brit Shalom like Ernst Simon and Martin Buber, who promoted a binational rather than a national state. They insisted that Arab-Jewish reconciliation be part of Zionism. The contempt of these practical kibbutz and Haganah members for the European intelligentsia was another kind of protest against the unwelcome carryover from the diaspora. While Yudka denounces the messianism of the ultra-Orthodox, the kibbutzniks mock the political messianism of those who think that they can have a country without fighting for it. When Yudka's given the floor again, he admits that he had not really known where his logic would take him in forcing the distinction between Judaism and Zionism. "Let's face it," he says, "we've already proven what I've been saying. Isn't that why we switched from speaking Yiddish to speaking Hebrew? And why we speak Hebrew according to the Sephardi pronunciation instead of how we used to pronounce it? Here in our country, we have no one to hide from, and yet we're ashamed of our past, hiding our identity from ourselves. You think that what I'm saying is radical, but what have we been doing other than rejecting Jewish history itself?" Now, the literary scholar Robert Alter, writing about this story, reminds us that fiction allows an author to attribute ideas to a character without taking full responsibilities for him or her. So Yudka's point of view does not necessarily represent the author. But to see what that viewpoint might be, we have to see how this sermon ends. Yudka is not ambivalent. In recovering Jewish sovereignty, he and his colleagues have done something more revolutionary and much more wholesome than the Bolsheviks did in Russia. Without waiting for the diplomatic resolution that Herzl had sought, or the cultural transformation that Ahad Ha'am deemed necessary, they simply went and did it. We always pause on the seemingly inverted sequence of the Jews' response when receiving the Torah at Sinai. Na'aseh v'nishma, we will do and we will listen. Though Yudka does not cite this biblical passage, the pioneering movement of which he forms part likewise acted first, leaving him to spell out the implications. And now that we've done it, here is the conundrum behind our actions. So Yudka comes after the fact. In this halting speaker, Hazaz has given us a story that holds together what is in danger of being torn apart. Yudka is indeed the new Jew of the Yishuv, the builder, defender of the old new land of Israel. Yet he is still enough of the diaspora Yidke to worry about rejecting the Judaism that brought them there. The people around that table prove that it was the diaspora that built the new land of Israel. And their adoption of new names and Hebrew pronunciation doesn't change the fact that they are all functioning in the language that diaspora Jews maintained since biblical days. Accordingly, the story does not really conclude. The listeners are relieved that having brought them to the edge of a cliff, Yudka pulls back a little. Maybe they will not have to accept the either-or choice between past and future. The denier of Jewish history points out that they themselves are undeniably its product. As Yudka gathers his thoughts, the chairman urges him to say what he wants. "Just go easy on the philosophy." The story ends with these three dots, with this ellipsis, which the rabbis of the Talmud would have designated with the Hebrew acronym Teku, to be resolved with the coming of the Messiah. The Talmud has many problems that remain philosophically unresolved, and now the theory and practice of Zionism belongs among them. Meanwhile, we thank God that the real Haganah did not wait for the resolution to Yudka's reflections before securing its recovered homeland. There's much else to consider in this story. The human hierarchy that contradicts the egalitarian ideology of the kibbutz, the improbable orator as the only trustworthy Jewish speaker since Moses provided that model, the brittle humorlessness of the then emergent Hebrew culture, and in the background, the simultaneous meeting in 1942 in Wannsee, Germany, of the German High Command to seal the final solution to the Jewish problem. Had Yudka asked to speak at a kibbutz meeting, there would also have been women around the table. The male Haganah leaders, of whom Yudka is one, represent the toughest part of the Yishuv and the hardest proof that his negative vision of Jewish history is over and done with, Yudka charts the straight road from the Tanakh to the Palmach, from the Bible to the strike units of the Haganah. But then, somewhat like a husband suing for divorce, he regrets what he stands to lose in dissolving the marriage. This story shows us that Zionism could never be a purely triumphalist movement because of the centuries of loss that preceded this reconquest and how much had to be left behind. Yudka, the prototypical little Jew of earlier Hebrew and Yiddish literature, could not declare victory over the civilization that brought him home. Hazaz had witnessed a revolution in Russia that was ruthlessly determined to eliminate the past, but that was not the Jewish way. It should not surprise us that so modest a Zionist work should be one of the very best. And so here we end. Next week we will be reading Franz Kafka's A Report to an Academy. And for now, I wish you happy reading.